Welcome. You're listening to the Mac Observer's Background Mode. This is your host, John Martellaro. And this week, my guest is science journalist and author, Maren McKenna. Maren, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Hey, thanks for being on the show. So, you are a journalist, author who specializes in public health, global health, food policy. You've written for National Geographic and many other publications. And you're a science book author and a TED speaker. Holy cow. Wow. That's awesome.
That would be me. Thank you very much.
Yes. But you told me before the show that you started off life as an English major and soon got into public health. How did all that happen?
Yeah, this is true. My undergraduate degree is in 16th century theater and 20th century poetry, which was exactly as useful for finding me a job as you might imagine.
Well, something must have inspired you to do that at an early age.
So the way that I got into what I do now, as I think is true for a lot of people, makes a lot of sense in retrospect. When I look back, it looks quite stepwise, but at the time it seemed completely random. So I get out of college, I have this incredibly illuminating humanities degree. I'm working with my best friend. We have a theater company in Washington, D.C. We don't have a space, but we have a company and we move around from space to space. And after a couple of years, we both realize, you know, we really need to get jobs that are going to pay us to live. And we decide we both need to go off to graduate school to do it. So we break up our company. She goes off to get a directing degree and I decide I'm going to go to journalism school because I think I want to be a writer. And it seems to me that getting a journalism degree would be a kind of, you know, imprimatur that would encourage people to hire me. So mm-hmm. I went to journalism school. And I thought I was going to journalism school to do arts journalism. But when I got out, it turned out that there were no jobs in arts journalism. There were only jobs in business journalism. And so in getting my master's, I had happened to have done a lot of work on what I suppose you could call investigative journalism, but I think of it as sort of documents journalism. And what I ended up doing was working in the upper Midwest, pouring through the profit and loss statements of savings and loans.
Is that something your boss asked you to do because you were a journalist? You go, oh, well, you know, I got this job. I better do what my boss asks.
Well, I was a business reporter, and this was the late 1980s. So the collapse of savings and loans in the Midwest, leading up to a pretty serious economic moment, was an important story. And some of those savings and loans were in the town where I worked, Rockford, Illinois, which is the second largest city in Illinois, and no one outside of Illinois has ever heard of it, I think. And so my boss, my editor, said, you have this fancy degree, you've done these things, do you think you can figure out what's going on with the savings and loans in our town? And I said, of course, one does not say no to one's editor if you can help it. And so I said, yes, I will try. And it turned out that it was quite clear in the very lengthy documents that we got that were all public record that they had been making very injudicious purchases of mobile home mortgages from Texas, and that had blown up their balance sheets. So that started me being an investigative reporter.
Did you kind of learn how to do that on the fly? I mean,
I sort of did.
Just sort of discover for yourself what investigative techniques, what kind of documents, who you needed to talk to, where what your information sources were? Did you kind of just learn that on the fly?
Yeah. I had a little bit of training in graduate school, but as is often the case, at least for the way that journalists used to work, maybe now still do, this was something that you sort of learned by doing. Here's a set of documents. They lead you to a person. That person points you to another set of documents. You learn the language in which those documents were inputted, or you find out how to find them. And a lot of investigative journalism really is, you know, tracking down things in that stepwise manner. Now it's much more online, of course, than it was back in the 80s and 90s, but because this involved going through enormous reams of printouts that I think have been done with a Daisy printer, a dot matrix printer, if anyone even knows what that still is.
Oh, yeah, we remember.
Green and white stripes all across the pages. So at any rate, that was my introduction to actually doing journalism. And from there,
Did you have to schedule appointments with people, and were they easy to talk to, or did they sense that you were probing? How did that go?
Yes and no. Yes, you had to schedule appointments with people. When you're asking people about profit and loss statements, jumping on them in, you know, a parking lot is not necessarily something that not only is it, will people not like that, but it's not necessarily very fruitful. So yes, and it was, they were very difficult stories to do, and people were very cranky about them. But we did do some good, because we did expose why it was that these institutions, one of which, maybe two of which, I think later went into receivership, were failing at, you know, in a town that really depended on them. So that was an exciting way to start being a journalist, and it sort of set a pattern for me for the next couple of years, in which I got involved in investigations that included a lot of looking at documents. And more and more, they came, I realized as I looked back at them, that except for that first one, they were all investigations that involved public health in some manner. And that kind of made me into the public health reporter that I ended up being, but I didn't set out to be a public health reporter. It happened first, and then the subject enchanted me, and then I had to stay.
Enchanted, the magic word. Made the transition from financial to health via enchantment. Interesting.
Which is, I suppose, kind of an odd thing to say, because when you write about
public it's a wonderful health, thing to say.
Well, you're often writing about things, or, you know, reporting in various media, whether you're writing or doing video or audio, about things that are very grave health threats. My first investigation involved cancer clusters around a closed nuclear weapons plant. My second involved sort of the social side effects of drug trade, illegal drug trade in particular towns in Ohio.
We're going through that in Denver here with Rocky Flats, doing statistical analysis.
Yes, exactly. So the work that I was doing was on one of the other plants that was in the same manufacturing chain as Rocky Flats. It was called Fernald, and it's in Ohio, west of Cincinnati, very close to the Indiana border, a place that was an early example of a lack of social justice and environmental justice, because it had been sited in a very poor area where all the people who believed they'd been given cancer by this very sloppily run plant at the time also had all of the confounders that would cause them to have cancer. They all smoked. They all had what a public health person would call poor socioeconomic status. Most of them had not gone to college. Some had not gone to high school. They didn't eat well. They didn't exercise. So they had all the predisposing factors to cancer, and they also had a badly run nuclear weapons plant in their backyard.
Isolating the variable, that's the key.
So in the sense of, you know, refining questions and pursuing an investigation and sort of being a detective, that's the way in which it was enchanting. All journalists, I think, struggle with this. You are enraptured by your subject, but you can never remember that your pleasure in unfolding the mystery cannot obscure for you the profound suffering that the people that you are writing about may be going through.
Mm-hmm. I want to back up a second here, just a little biographical background. I'm intrigued. You mentioned to me before the show that you were born in New York, but you grew up in England. But you don't have an English accent.
I don't now, but I did then. My family came back to America for me to go to high school. I'm the oldest child in my family. So, yeah, so I was born in Brooklyn, before Brooklyn was hip, I have to say, in a neighborhood that I think may still not be hip. I'm actually from Bay Ridge, and for people who know New York, I went to PS 102. Only New Yorkers say that PS stands for public school. And when I was seven, my father, who was a mechanical engineer, took a job in England building plants that I guess made fertilizer, but they were dealing with the byproducts of petroleum cracking. And so he worked in various places in England, and he parked us, myself, my younger brother, in a town just inside the M25 ring road that goes around Greater London, kind of halfway in between Heathrow and Gatwick airports. And that was my childhood. So I was a day student at a French nuns boarding school in town. I had a uniform that had about a million pieces to it, including a blazer and a boater in the summer and specially colored Wellington boots in the winter. And I had a marvelous time. And when we came back, my parents used to have tapes in which I sounded exactly English. And when I speak to English people now, I still do. It's quite alarming how I drop into the accent right away.
I was going to ask you if you can turn it on and turn it off like actors do. That's amazing.
I don't think my accent, I think my accent, though, is the England of the 70s. So it's probably not an English accent now. It's stored away in, you know, in a drawer in my brain. I brought it out. It wouldn't sound like modern English.
Interesting. So then after the enchantment with in environmental health, you end up covering the CDC in Atlanta.
Right.
Is that where you got interested in a related subject in superbugs and antibiotics?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's exactly right. So
you worked for the Atlanta Constitution?
I did. I worked for the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. At the time, there used to be two separate newspapers in Atlanta, and sometime in, I probably have the history wrong, but I would guess the 80s or maybe the early 90s, they collapsed into one. And I came down from working in Boston because I'd been doing all these investigations, and they were all public health-based, and the newspaper in Atlanta said, you know, we have this federal agency in our backyard, and it deals with diseases, and you've been investigating diseases in various kinds. I just come off an investigation of the earliest cases of what later came to be called Gulf War syndrome from the first Persian Gulf War. And they said, we've never really paid attention to the CDC, at least not for many years, and we're kind of curious about it. So come down here and just find your way inside it. Tell us the stories of these people. This is at a moment between the interest in the CDC occasioned by the start of HIV in the United States and the interest in the CDC occasioned by 9/11 and the anthrax attacks that came right after it. So I was in a lucky spot at a point where they were not in the public eye and a little more relaxed about their letting outsiders in. And it was a marvelous time, another enchanting subject, because the CDC is effectively the disease police for most of the world, even though they are an agency of the U.S. government. And my job was to find out when they were investigating an outbreak of something interesting and try to talk my way onto the plane. And so I ended up going all over the place with their investigative teams, and it was a tremendous amount of fun.
It's a very common thread. I've talked to a lot of guests who had parents who were engineers, computer people, teachers. They buy their child an Apple II or a Mac. They grew up being kind of techie. Their parents lead them along a particular path. They get interested in one thing in college, and then they branch out to another thing, and they find a passion, and then they get lucky, and then they get some expertise, and then that expertise escalates into a position, and then they fall in love with that. It turns into a career. It's an amazing process. It's an amazing process to hear.
Sadly, I'm afraid journalism as a career is probably nowhere near as lucrative as the people with the early Apple IIs that you're talking about.
Well, let me ask you a question along those lines. Do you fear for investigative journalism and newspapers in this country?
Oh, absolutely, I do. And I don't think anyone has solved the problem of how to pay for journalism in this new environment. And especially, you know, now I no longer work for a newspaper and I don't work full time for any magazine. I'm a freelancer effectively with various kinds of overlapping contractual relationships. So, you know, the magic of putting journalism online was that it took away the production of journalism from the people owning the means of production. You know, we used to say back in, I guess, the 60s and 70s of journalism that you should never argue with someone who buys ink by the barrel. Well, no one needs to buy the ink anymore, right? You can, if you choose to, put your own journalism online. The challenge isn't finding a place to publish, it's finding a place to pay you. And that gets more and more challenging all the time.
The challenge for us readers is to find authoritative, well-researched sites from people who know what they're doing and make our analysis based on that. And that's hard to do from a reader's perspective.
Yes, exactly. It's very true.
Well, I think this is a good time to take a break. When we come back, I want to chat with you about your books and some other subjects. So, folks, we'll be back in 60 seconds. Stay with us. We're talking to Maren McKenna.
Hello there, all you fabulous Background Mode listeners. I'm Kelly Gamont with the Mac Observer, and I just want to say a few words about how you can support all the things we do. If you're thinking about buying something from Apple, Amazon, or Mac Mall, just go to the Mac Observer's homepage, where we have a section called Support TMO. Or you can just enter macobserver.com/Apple Store, all one word, and that will take you to our special page for Apple and our other affiliates. If you make a purchase from one of our partners this way, the Mac Observer receives a small compensation for sending business their direction. Pretty cool, right? And you don't pay a penny more. This small fee from our affiliates helps us continue to bring you TMO's daily news, reviews, tips, how-tos, and podcasts like this one. So the next time you're thinking about an online purchase, come to TMO's homepage and support the Mac Observer. Thanks. Back to you, John.
Thanks, Kelly. We're back. We're chatting with Maren McKenna, science journalist and author. Maren, you've published a couple of interesting books. The first one is Superbug.
Is Beating Back the Devil.
Is that the first book you published, and then Superbug came later?
That's right.
And the subtitle is On the Front Lines with the Disease Detectives and the Epidemic Intelligence Service. I never heard of that. It sort of sounds like a spy agency, you know, collecting intel on bugs and disease. Tell me about that.
That reaction of I've never heard about this is exactly why I wrote this book, which came out in 2004. So here's how this happened. I'm working at the CDC. I'm covering disease outbreaks. I'm trying to get FaceTime with everyone there, from the people who do the special pathogens work, which is very scary things like smallpox and Ebola and Lassa fever, to people who try to sort out, you know, what the effect of smoking is on a population or what's going on in the groundwater. And 9/11 happens. And after 9/11 happens, the anthrax attacks, the first successful fatal bioterrorism attack in U.S. history on the U.S. mainland, carried out by means of dried anthrax bacteria loaded into envelopes and sent to Capitol Hill and to the media. And the first unfortunate victim was a photographer for the National Enquirer in Florida on, I think it was October 4th, 2001. So that occasioned an enormous amount of alarm and public health mobilization. And the CDC was sent to all the places where the anthrax had arrived, to New York City, to Capitol Hill, to Florida. And I managed to work out a deal where I embedded with one of the teams going to Capitol Hill, looking for all the places where letters might have been sent and trying to figure out who had been exposed. And this was a massive task. And in the end, something like 60,000 people in those months were tested for possible anthrax exposure, and thousands of people went on long-term antibiotics for months to try to control the possible growth of anthrax in their chests, essentially, is where the spores collect. And while I was doing this, in sort of makeshift offices up the street from the Capitol on North Capitol Street in D.C., watching people fall asleep at their desks and then wake up again and keep inputting data, I realized that almost all the people I saw who were the ground troops of this were really pretty young. And as I got started talking to them, I heard over and over that they were either just out of medical residency or they just finished their PhDs, and they were all members of this mysterious corps, the Epidemic Intelligence Service. So the Epidemic Intelligence Service is the CDC's shock troops. It's about 80 people a year who are starting their careers, who give the CDC 2 years of their lives in exchange for 2 years of training that will make the rest of their careers. And they are the people who get on the plane in the middle of the night, sometimes not knowing where they're going until their visa gets handed to them as they go. And after the anthrax emergency was over, I asked the CDC if I could spend more time with these people. And they'd never done that before. And it took them a while to think about it. But they eventually allowed me to embed with the class of 2002. Now, EIS classes are named for the year they enter, not the year they graduate. So this was a group that was the first group to enter the EIS after that first fatal successful bioterrorism attack. And they lived their 2 years wondering whether there was going to be another one. Now, fortunately, as we know, there hasn't been. But it was a moment that took the CDC back to its earliest beginnings as an agency of the U.S. government founded between World War II and the Korean War, wondering what threats to the homeland would be. And so I followed this group. I went through their training with them. I sat through all their epidemiology classes. I caught up with them as they went around the country and around the world doing various kinds of outbreak response. And in the end, I wrote this book, Beating Back the Devil, on the front lines with the disease detectives of the Epidemic Intelligence Service, which tells the story of that first year, starting with bioterror training, ending with the international outbreak of SARS, which began outside Hong Kong in China, and interweaving that story with the stories of the previous 50 years. Because when I started investigating this, I realized that EIS members had been part of every major disease outbreaks that, you know, that we have in the history books. They were there at the start of AIDS. One of them saw the very first cases of AIDS in Los Angeles that were the first to be written up. They were part of the end of smallpox. They were part of the start of polio vaccination. But the CDC had never let them put their names to things. So they were this stealth force that had never really gotten attention. And I thought it was time to change that.
Awesome. Awesome. There are people doing interesting work in this country, and they have a story to tell. If only you want to connect with them and listen and hear them tell their story. Amazing. Amazing. And that led you to...
Well, that led me to do
another TED Talk, right?
So I, one of the outbreaks that I went on in that year that I was following them, summer of 2002 to summer of 2003, the first of their 2 years of service, was in Los Angeles. A young physician had gone there to work in the LA Health Department, the Department of Health Services, I think it's formally called. And he was dealing with a perplexing outbreak of skin infections that all seemed to occur among a certain group of people. They started as small hot boils, but they expanded very rapidly. They ate into people's tissues. They infected their blood and their bones. They put people in the intensive care unit, and it turned out to be MRSA, what we think of as, that's drug-resistant staph. And it was my first introduction, really, to the problem of antibiotic resistance, which has turned out to be kind of my major topic for most of the past 10 years. Mm-hmm. I was so interested in this outbreak because if people think of antibiotic resistance, which is a little more common now than it was 10 years ago, but still not very common, they tend to think of it as something that happens to people in hospitals or in nursing homes or people at the ends of their lives, people in ICUs, people who are in danger of hospital-caused infections. But what this outbreak in Los Angeles that I saw underlined was that this infection in particular, and antibiotic resistance in general, was moving out into the wider world, what medicine calls the community. Though when they say that, what they mean is anything outside the walls of a hospital. And around the same time, it was becoming clear to me that that newspapers were sliding into the trench of the 2008 recession, and it was going to be time to start doing something else because opportunities were going to be vanishing. And so I left newspapers. I became a freelancer to get some bridge funding. I got a grant that unfortunately no longer exists to spend a year observing an aspect of healthcare. And I thought I'd write a book about emergency rooms, maybe, because emergency room personnel are very like reporters in their personalities, and they're very appealing people to spend time with. They're kind of adrenaline junkies. And so I got a grant that let me do 8 overnight shifts a month for a year in hospital emergency rooms around the United States. And instead of writing a book about
emergency rooms, just wow.
Yeah,
continue, please.
It was fun. It happened that every night, as I stood at intake with whoever was doing triage, whatever city I was in, there would be tons of people with the kind of skin infections and tissue infections and blood and bone infections and nearly fatal pneumonias that I'd seen in that first Los Angeles outbreak. And it turned out that I happened to be in those emergency rooms in the peak year of the MRSA epidemic in the United States. And that made me think, oh, this is my next book. And so the next book, Superbug, my second book, it's essentially the biography of that organism, how it arose, why it was so troublesome, how it was that we were not prepared for it to move from just hospitals to being a problem of everyday life and sports teams and kids in schools, and how antibiotic resistance generally was becoming a much more complicated and widespread problem than most people were really prepared to confront.
Are we losing the battle?
Yeah, at the moment, yes, we are.
Are there any prospects or hopes for specialized kinds of exotic technology and research in the future that could deal with it?
So the interesting thing about talking to anyone who has any connection to the tech world is that when you talk about antibiotic resistance, they instantly go to the meme of technological optimism. Mm-hmm. There must be a drug or a device that is going to fix this for us.
Nanotubes, fibers, nanites, intelligently engineered organisms.
In fact, that may be true. That it may be true that 10 years down the road, there's going to be a diagnostic that will solve our problems with giving the wrong drugs or giving them for the wrong period of time. It may be that it will speed up drug development to such a point that we're no longer in the kind of valley of death we're in now. But at the moment, we have almost no new antibiotics. We are nowhere near far enough down the road for diagnostics, and antibiotic resistance is burgeoning. And what is unfortunately left to us to do at the moment to keep it from getting worse until the technological cavalry arrives is to do a lot of small, granular, individual responsibility kind of actions. The same kind of actions that are going to make a difference to climate change.
I was going to ask you about that. Excellent.
Antibiotic resistance and climate change are very similar problems.
Really? Tell me about that.
They are completely different, of course, in their core and in their effects, but they're very similar in that they're massive problems created over a very long time.
Oh, but you're not talking about a specific connection. Like the warming of the atmosphere leads to the breeding of more organisms or something like that.
Well, it may, in fact. Yeah, I mean, there may be a cause and effect, but that as the climate warms, some disease organisms will find it more friendly. That's entirely possible. But what I mean is that antibiotic resistance is like climate change in that it's an overwhelming problem that wasn't caused by any single action, but by many small actions repeated over a very long period of time. And therefore, it's also not something that can be solved by any single.
Are you talking about, when you talk about many small actions, are you talking about over-prescription of antibiotics, soaps, and so on?
About people, people badgering their doctors for antibiotics when they don't need them, doctors giving antibiotics because they're scored on how much or how little time they spend with patients, and writing a script is one of the quickest interactions in medicine, far quicker than having a chat with someone about how maybe they don't need that prescription after all. From the beginning of the antibiotic era, we've been using antibiotics to effectively create what we think of as factory farming, which not only caused meat from livestock to be a vector for antibiotic-resistant bacteria, but also put antibiotic resistance out into the world, out into the environment through surface water and groundwater and dust. So there's many, many complicating factors that have made this possible, and many things that have to be done by individuals, like turning away from antibacterial soaps that when they don't need them, which we mostly don't, from not taking antibiotics when they don't need them. Things that individually, like thinking that buying a light bulb is going to save the polar bears from drowning. Those two feel so different. People think, there is no point in my buying this light bulb. Mm. But in fact, it does matter if enough of us buy the light bulb. And it does matter that we not take antibiotics inappropriately, or that we not buy meat raised with routine antibiotic use, if enough of us do it.
I'm seeing more and more of that. I go to Whole Foods, and that's a big thing, is, this product does not contain antibiotics, or this animal.
It is. And a really interesting thing about that is that all of that has happened quite recently. Now, Whole Foods obviously has been around for a couple of decades at this point, and they were leaders in this. But out in the mass market of food, both food production and food service, just in the past couple of years, there's been a really significant consumer changeover away from the routine use of antibiotics in livestock raising. And as a result, response by really major companies, McDonald's, Costco, Walmart, Subway. Here in the South where I live, Chick-fil-A. Chick-fil-A has gone antibiotic-free, which I find just delightful.
What are the forces in society that cause these corporations to respond in that manner? Is it a sense of social responsibility? Is it consumer pressure? Is it purchasing trends?
In this case, it was totally consumer pressure because the U.S. government, and it's different in the U.S. than it is from Europe, and both of those are different than what's going on in the developing world or in the BRICS economies. In the U.S., up until this past year, actually up until January of this year, the FDA and the pharma and agricultural industries were at a stalemate that had existed for decades over what to do about farm use of antibiotics. Not antibiotics to cure animals that were sick, but antibiotics to make animals faster and to protect them from the conditions of intensive farming. While that stalemate was going on, a really quite extraordinary coalition of many different types of consumers, from large catering companies that feed Silicon Valley companies to the food buying of universities and hospital systems, to really just kind of individual moms banding together, all rose up and said, "We are just not going to buy this anymore." And the companies, not waiting for government regulation, but listening to their consumers, said, "Okay, we can make that change."
Sounds like you're talking about your next book, discussing antibiotics and agriculture.
As it happens. This is my next book, which will be published in September 2017. Is the story of how we came to use antibiotics in agriculture and how we discovered that was a bad idea.
Cool. Going to send me a copy?
Of course, I will.
Excellent. So, finally, we're running out of time here. I just have a couple more questions for you. This is great stuff, by the way. Thank you. We've seen during the election campaign the politicization of several technical areas, defense, security, encryption, other technical areas, EPA, and so on. Do you perceive that public health and the work the CDC does is well beyond politicization, or are there some elements that affect it in that regard?
It would be nice to think that public health was beyond politicization, because let me tell you, the microbes don't care which way you vote.
That's right. As Neil deGrasse Tyson says, science is true whether you believe it or not.
Microbes attack you no matter what it says on your voter registration card. But the reality is that there are certain aspects of public health that are definitely identified with one political agenda or another. A perfect example is how public health entangles with gun violence and with Second Amendment rights. The CDC has not been allowed to conduct research into the public health effect of gun violence. That means things like how many people actually are shot each year and what are the circumstances under which they're shot, since the 1990s, because a then Republican Congress took away the funding for it. An example that we're facing right now is that one of the ways that the CDC is funded is through a mechanism called the Public Health Prevention Fund, which funnels money to all 50 states and the territories for things like outbreak response, if an epidemic starts, for things like dealing with the opioid epidemic. All of that money comes through the Affordable Care Act. If the Affordable Care Act is repealed, as the incoming Congress and incoming presidency wants to do, the CDC, and therefore the individual states, will lose about $900 million in a single year, and over 5 years. This is a calculation that was just done by a nonprofit called the Trust for America's Health. The states will lose about $3 billion in public health funds. So that means things like if a scary disease starts in your state may not have the funding or personnel to go after it. It may mean that they can't run STD clinics. And at the moment, gonorrhea is outrunning every single antibiotic that we have. It may mean simple things like no more smoking cessation programs or no more well baby programs. And that's a way in which public health is intrinsically tied up with politics, whether we'd like it to be or not.
Very interesting. This has been a grand tour, scary, illuminating, fascinating. I'm afraid we're out of time, but I want to thank you so much for this background on all the work that you've done and the research and investigative journalism and the science. I continue to follow you on Twitter with glee and appreciate the work that you've been doing. So thank you so much for this. I appreciate you being on the show with me.
Thank you very much.
And if the listeners would like to try to contact you, communicate with you, do you have a suggestion?
Absolutely. So my core social identity is probably Twitter, where I am Maryn MCK. That's MaryNMCK. My site is MaryNMcKenna.com, and there's a contact form on that. And on either of those, probably mostly on Twitter. If they'd like to know more about antibiotic use in agriculture, they will hear news of the new book, which comes out in September from National Geographic Penguin Random House and is called Big Chicken.
Okay, we'll look forward to that. So thank you again for being on the show, Maryn. It was a pleasure. And listeners, I hope you enjoyed this fascinating, somewhat scary, and very informative tour of our health status and superbugs and our life with antibiotics and everything that's involved in that. So thanks for coming by, and we'll see you next week on the Mac Observer's Background Mode.